Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the free enterprise system when we come back. Well, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause in Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper, things like stocks and bonds and Federal Reserve notes and credit cards, debt and usury. Back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and of clad coin or currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew as a matter of law, that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they'd first have to take away their gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we're going to have to first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that. It's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschoolers. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us directly, 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about this thing called the free enterprise system. Here in the West, we have downgraded our free enterprise system. If you have attended public schools, college, and so on, you've probably been told how wicked, evil, and immoral it is and how it needs to be replaced and changed, or at least it needs to be fixed. There's something desperately wrong with it. And so we're taking a look from the point of view of that free enterprise system. What are the positive sides of free enterprise? And then what are the negative sides? And let's see if we can evaluate it. Maybe it's not as bad as we thought it was, or maybe it's worse than we've ever imagined. Foundations of Liberty has an article here. In fact, it's the entire book for this publication called The Free Enterprise System. It's put out by the MacArthur Institute, and they're located at 946th Avenue in East Moline, Illinois. That's 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, and their zip code is 61244. Foundations of Liberty now is the title of the booklet. That's what you're looking for, and it's put out bi-monthly, 26 issues a year, about 100 pages, and they have different topics every publication. This publication, the topic is the free enterprise system, and there's a series of essays concerning free enterprise by various economists and various people that are interested in it. And remember the name and address here. It's called the MacArthur Institute. So if you want a copy of the book, you'd write to the MacArthur Institute, 946th Avenue. East Moline, Illinois. And the number is, the zip code is 61244. And then if you want to go zip plus 4, then you add on dash 4406. If you want to call first, the number is 309-796-1485. Again, that area code 309-796-1485. Now, there's a moral case to be made for competitive capitalism. Competitive capitalism. Now, the word capitalism, if you'll remember in our previous discussion here, came from Karl Marx. He called it Des Kapital, spelled with a K, is a German thought, Des Kapital. All of the Western writers refer to it by other terms. They're not talking about money as capital, they're talking about the goods, talking about production. So we use the example here of making 20 chairs, and then we have to start paying protection, because we're going to have bad guys come in here and demand protection. It could be the mafia, could be robbers, and so we have to hire the police. And so it doesn't make any difference whether we're paying this protection money to the police or we're paying it to the mafia. What it boils down to is that none of us are ever going to end up with 100% of what we produce. That's the bottom line. So now the question arises, well, how much of what we produce can we keep? And here in the United States, we are witnessing less and less. When we started off here with our taxing system in 1787, the federal government was taking nothing, and now they take 42% of everything that you create and produce. And that's on the low end. They take 33%, that's 16.1% plus 17%. That's a third of everything you create and produce in just two taxes, Social Security and income tax. And there's 14 total taxes. So when you add all those total taxes up, it could be as high as 74%. But the general rule is that it takes about half. And under the Bush years, there was some tax relief that came about. And so it's down around 42%. That's about the maximum income tax. Nobody ever pays the maximum, you know, if they got their heads on straight, but you're paying a large proportion of it. And so now the question arises, well, where does the balancing point come? And with me, when we took, at the Atlantis Manufacturing Company, my own personal experience was, when the government took took two-thirds and left me with one-third, they had exceeded the balance point and I closed the company. I said, I'm not going to do this. See, I'm not going to work and produce $1 million a year and give $200,000 to the government so that I can keep $100,000 and spend $700,000 on production. I'm not going to do that. Now, maybe you'd say, well, you're just a greedy capitalist. Well, I can do better than that. That's my point. And then on top of that, the government comes in and gets in the way. If the government were taking that two-third and stayed out of the way, I might still be doing it. But not only do they take two-thirds, but then they get in your road and make it very difficult for you to produce, period. And so I looked at that bureaucracy and I said, you know, I'll let you bureaucrats, you know, bureaucrats are parasites. And so I said, hey, I'm going to let you parasites feed on yourselves. This host is going to bow out of the game. So I did. I bowed out of the game. And somebody's going to say, well, good riddance. Well, I don't know that that's necessarily true. You see, I was employing 30 people. And right now, while government is adding up the statistics, you know, you're officially telling us that your unemployment rate's 8.9%. It would look like to me that everybody that could produce anything that would employ anybody would be an asset. That was my take on it. But evidently, that's not what the bureaucracy thought. And so, okay, you made things so tough for me. I said, yeah, to hell with it. I'm not going to do that. Now, there's a lot of other guys out there just like me. And I pointed out to you last time, I said, now, 65% of all the employment in America is in small business, that is, companies that have 100 employees or less, somewhere between 1 and 100 employees. That's where 65% of you people work. 25% work for big business, and those are the thousands and thousands of workers at IBM, General Motors, General Electric, and so on. And then 10% work for government. And that's where the labor pool is divided up. Now, government's still hiring people, at least last time I saw some numbers. You know, government's out here trying to hire people and put more people to work. But, you know, if everybody worked for the government, then who's going to fix your car? You know, now the government's getting into the automobile business, and they're getting into the insurance business, and the government's getting into the banking business. That's what we're doing here. The government is going to take over all business worldwide. The government's going to direct all business. Now, where we've tested that in the past, it hasn't worked very well. Poverty comes from it. And we call that socialism, fascism, Nazism, communism. We have these isms that we hang on there. Now, we have another term called capitalism over here, but this capitalism, if you're applying that term to the free enterprise system, that's the exact opposite to all these isms, which is where we're at right now, the moral case for competitive capitalism. Now, what's under attack is the capitalist system, and it's attacked mainly on ethical grounds as being materialistic, selfish, unjust, immoral, savagely competitive, callous, cruel, destructive. If the capitalistic system is really worth preserving, it is futile today to defend it merely on technical grounds as being more productive. For example, unless we can show also that the socialist attacks on ethical grounds are false and baseless. Now, I'm going to make a distinction here. I don't think that General Motors is a capitalist business. I think it's a fascist business. In fact, when you get over 100 employees, I think I could make the case that once a business gets to 100 employees or more, I think we're starting to deal with fascism. I don't think we're dealing with capitalism. Capitalism, or the free market, or the free enterprise system, works in family units. It works in small increments with limited government down here at the local level. I operate a little small private school. And then there's only three people that work in this private school, me, my wife, and my son. Three. It's all we need. Family business employs three people, and it produces a service that's wanted and needed, as is evidenced by the customers that buy the service. That's how simple that is. Now, we could franchise this and put schools all over America. Hell, we could do like General Motors and have dealers all over the place. And I'm not sure that the character of our business would hold together, but you know, that's what people do. They want to make money. We're not here to make money. We're not here to do it free, but we're not here because we're trying to become another Donald Trump or a Bill Gates or another General Motors or Harvard, Princeton, or Yale. In fact, I don't think that education necessarily has to come from some big institution. What would be wrong instead of having big Harvards and Yales and Princetons? What if you just had hundreds and thousands of little private schools around? Back in ancient times, we used to have people like Plato and Aristotle. If you'll remember in the Bible, the Apostle Paul studied law at the feet of Gamaliel, a private teacher, a private tutor. What would be wrong with private tutors in small independent schools, which would employ school teachers operating their own little private independent schools? Instead of me being a college professor and taking a salary from some big big business, you know, like Harvard. What if all the teachers in Harvard just operated their own little private schools? What would be wrong with that? Because that's the model for competitive capitalism or the free enterprise system. And it's the model that we followed here in America between 1787 and 1933. From the Civil War period until 1933, some big businesses developed, you know, like United States Steel and the Ford Motor Company and General Motors. But these big multinational corporations have little or nothing to do with competitive capitalism. They have to do with monopoly. And when they get that big, we're talking about monopolies. Now, here in the United States, we used to have 2,600 car companies from 1900 until today. That's about 109 years. In that 109 years, there have been recorded 2,600 car companies started in this country building automobiles. Today, we have three American car companies, General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford. And two of those are about to leave the scene. What we have witnessed here in this 109 years is a trend toward competitive monopoly, not competitive capitalism. That's monopoly. Now, should government promote this competitive monopoly? That's another question that ought to be brought up, because that's exactly what government is doing today. They're promoting this competitive monopoly. And if you wanted to go out and build an automobile today, you couldn't do it. But the government has imposed rules and regulations on these car companies that no little company could ever get over the hurdle. You could never get into the business. And so the government then, with its regulations, comes in and makes competition or free market enterprise impossible. And the more they do that, then the more people they crowd out of the free enterprise system, and then the more poverty you see. Now let's take a look at the program here. The Communist Manifesto and Capitalism, Great Engine of Growth. That, so said Karl Marx, is noted. Karl Marx noted in the Communist Manifesto that capitalism is a great engine of growth. It's a proposition with which today few informed observers of the economic scene would disagree. And yet the free market system continues to be viewed as materialistic, unjust, callous, cruel, and therefore immoral by great numbers of people all over the world. And this is especially true among many of, if not most, intellectuals. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in a National Review article in 1978, acknowledged that it is almost universally recognized that the West shows all of the world a way to successful economic development. However, and unfortunately, he goes on to say, many people living in the West are dissatisfied with their own society, and they despise it or accuse it of not being up to the level of maturity attained by mankind. Now, following this line of thought, the world continues to witness attempts by supposedly beneficent dictators to remake mankind in terms of some utopian and, more often than not, very vaguely specified image. And unfortunately, societies designed from the top down to promote morality are rarely successful. For instance, the Ayatollah Khomeini's Iran is an excellent example of a spiritual intolerance which does violence to mind and body. Indeed, totalitarian regimes frequently appeal to morality as a convenient device to assist them in the subjugation of their peoples. Henry Hazlitt cites an incident recorded in Marx's correspondence with Engels at the First International Communist International, in which Marx admits that, quote, I was obliged to insert in the preamble two phrases about duty and right, truth, morality, and justice. But these lamentable phrases are placed in such a way that they can do no harm. In fact, as Max Eastman records, the notion of an earthly paradise in which men shall dwell together in millennial brotherhood is used to justify crimes and depravity surpassing anything the modern world has ever experienced. So let's consider the alternatives first. The morality or justice of the system of competitive capitalism, therefore, cannot be fully appreciated until the alternatives are observed in the real world and then evaluated. Because, as Arthur Shenfield reminds us, it is a plain historical fact that the treatment of man by man became conspicuously more humane side by side with the rise of the free enterprise system. Attitudes and policies toward the punishment of crime, treatment of women, lunatics and the feeble-minded, the lame, and in attitudes toward slavery and serfdom, the treatment of workers, it changed significantly for the better during the rise of industrial competitive capitalism. There was even an explosion of charitable endeavor in the countries which bore the most marked impress of capitalist principle and practice. The economic system of private property, voluntary exchange, and free markets brought with it, according to Shenfield, an improvement on what had gone before, and very definitely an improvement over the socialist dictatorships of the 20th century. Now, for centuries, in pre-capitalist Christendom, men were insistently urged to lay up their treasures, not in this world, but in heaven, to eschew greed and selfishness, to care for the poor, the sick, the widow, and the orphan, to treat all Christians, if not others, as brothers. And yet the normal and universal treatment of man by man, in every respect, was so inhuman by our present standards that we would be unable to picture it to ourselves were it not that we know it to be matched in the post-capitalist socialist countries of our time. And these socialist countries are conspicuous not merely for their pervasive cruelty and oppression, but also for their loud claims to be in process of building a comradely society free from greed and selfishness. So let's just pause here for a moment and think about this. And take a look at the socialist countries around the world. You know, China, North Korea, Russia, the old Soviet Union. And then ask yourself, well, compared with, let's say, England, Ireland, Canada, Australia, Brazil, then ask yourself, well, which are the more lenient, more tolerant, more prosperous? I think that if we looked at Hitler, Mussolini, Genghis Khan, Stalin, I mean, these are brutal, repressive regimes, irrespective of their economics. And then somebody will say, well, they have to be in order to establish themselves. Okay, well, now isn't Russia pretty well established in China? And now that they're established, did you notice that the Chinese have embraced the free enterprise system? That's their economic model. They're following the free enterprise system. They don't have OSHA and the EPA to contend with. The government has got out of the business world. They're not trying to dictate and tell these businessmen how to do their thing. And now they have a class of businessmen over there, multi-million-dollar businessmen coming over here to the United States and buying up all of our toxic foreclosed houses. Where in the hell did that come from? Didn't have that 25 or 30 years ago. Now we look at the history then of these socialist regimes and their socialist policies, and we find that they're very inhumane. Now, following the lead of the economist Benjamin Rogge, it is in fact the case that the most important part of the case for economic freedom is not its dramatic success in promoting economic growth, but rather its consistency with certain fundamental moral principles of life itself. For personal freedom, and therefore economic and political freedom, is not ethically indifferent, but a necessary condition of morality. Now, Friedrich Hayek reminds us of certain fundamental conditions of the moral life. He said, "It's an old discovery that morals and moral values will grow only in an environment of freedom, and that in general, moral standards of people and classes are high only where they have long enjoyed freedom, and proportional to the amount of freedom they have possessed. That freedom is the matrix required for the growth of moral values. Indeed, not merely one value among many, but the source of all values. And it's almost self-evident. And it's only where the individual has choice and its inherent responsibility that he has occasion to affirm existing values and to contribute to their further growth and to earn moral merit." So let's take a look at morality in the market. It appears that the free market system, in which only voluntary and mutually beneficial exchange are permitted, is a necessary condition for a moral order in which the integrity of the individual conscience is respected. And Hayek points out in The Road to Serfdom that only where we ourselves are responsible for our own interests has our decision moral value, and freedom to order our own conduct in the sphere where material circumstances force a choice upon us, and responsibility for the arrangement of our own life according to our own conscience, is the air in which alone moral sense grows and in which moral values are daily recreated in the free decision of the individual. Responsibility, not to a superior, but to your own conscience, the awareness of a duty not exacted by compulsion, and to bear the consequences of one's own decision, are the very essence of any morals which deserve the name. Now, did you notice, we've had some real philanthropists. You know, Bill Gates is a philanthropist, and he's out taking his billions of dollars, and he put it into a trust, and he's out busily spending that money now trying to better humanity, trying to do things for the poor and the downtrodden. Andrew Carnegie did that. And many, many Americans who have made millions and billions of dollars have taken their money, and they've given it away. And Andrew Carnegie used to build a lot of libraries. Now let's stop and think about the charitable contributions made by Joe Sixpack. Joe Sixpack is not going to give $1 million to somebody or some institution, but Joe puts a dollar into a cup that's sitting on the counter in the supermarket for the benefit of little Timmy over here who needs a liver transplant, or he needs a kidney transplant, or something like that. Have you ever seen those little cups, you know, sitting there, donate to this or that or something else? Now let's take, you know, we got 300 million people here in the United States, and I wouldn't say that all of them give money, but most of us do. Most of us give some money to charity. And we give more money to charity than all of the philanthropists, all of the Bill Gateses and the Andrew Carnegies combined. Bill Gates has got $37 billion that he could give away. But 300 million Americans give that much away every year. Hey, and when Bill Gates is all through with his $37 billion, Joe Sixpack's still going to be out there putting his dollar in the cup. When I was a kid, they used to pass the cup around quite often for the March of Dimes. In those days, we didn't give dollars, we gave dimes. But a dime then was probably worth more than a dollar is today. So we put our dimes in the cup when they would pass the cup around. And it worked miracles. Then over time, And the same thing is true with tuberculosis and a whole host and plethora of diseases that government, and here's President Nixon, well-meaning, I'm sure he was, said we're going to declare war on cancer and give billions of dollars to cancer research, and you haven't got a cancer cure. But when Joe Sixpack was putting his dimes into the cup, he came up with a cure for polio, didn't you? If you take a look at what has been accomplished by charity from Joe Sixpack and compare that with all the government largesse combined, there's no comparison. So Joe Sixpack out here, in our millions, putting a dollar in this cup, gives more than all the philanthropists combined. Now, that's charity from the bottom up, and it's not compulsive. It's not, you know, nobody is sticking a gun at your head and saying, put a dollar in there. So when government comes along and they take money and they want to declare war on cancer and they want to take your money and donate it to charity, they're actually taking your money and donating it to the pharmaceutical industry. Now, that's compulsive giving, and I resent that. I don't want my tax dollars to go for a cancer cure. I'm not interested in government-sponsored charity at all, and I'll resist that. I'm all in favor of charity, and when we take a look at charity and we have compulsive charity, then we find that more and more people give less and less to those cups. That's all that boils down to. Now, as the recession deepens and as the depression grows, you're going to have less and less charitable contributions. And here in our local area, to give you an illustration, they're on TV the other day, and they're lamenting the fact that the local soup kitchens and the local food banks are really in a bind. People are giving less and less money as the recession and depression increases. They're giving less money to charity. Well, that's because they've got less money to give. And competitive capitalism gives Joe Sixpacks and the little guys down here a better standard of living, and they have more money to give. Bill Gates isn't going to hurt. Bill Gates is still going to make billions. But the little guys that are working for Bill Gates, when he lays them off, are going to have less and less. And those in their millions of people, when they quit giving their $1, a million people that give a dollar give $1 million to charity. And those same million people, when they withhold a dollar, take $1 million from charity. Bill Gates isn't giving out millions. There aren't a lot of people out there giving out millions and millions. There's a few. But there are millions of people giving $1. That's the point. Now, the process by which we satisfy human wants through social cooperation do not, of course, exhaust the purposes to which individuals aspire. The search for personal happiness and inner peace must be found within the individual alone. Nevertheless, mankind's social relationships are generally far more peaceful under a system of private property and free trade. The period between the Napoleonic Wars and the First World War, the heyday of competitive capitalism, represented a century relatively free of the brutality of war. And furthermore, Schoenfeld, Hayek, and others remind us that competitive capitalism was the first social system in human history to direct man's desire to become rich to the peaceful supply of greater quantities of goods and services for his fellow human beings, especially greater abundance for the working class and for the poor. And remember, Schoenfeld warns, the alternative to serving other men's wants through voluntary exchange is seizing power over them. Where socialism has prevailed, it has invariably meant not only lower living standards for most people, but also their reductions to serfdom by the new privileged class of socialist rulers. The case for the morality and justice of the system of capitalism rests on the intimate and complementary connection which exists between private property and the voluntary arrangements and the sovereignty of the individual over his own life. In fact, one might say that capitalism, far from dehumanizing man, allowed him at least to assume the full individuality which Christianity had always accorded him as the possessor of a distinctive moral conscience. Paul Johnson reminds us, however, that we tend to take the concept of individuality for granted, and yet it is a comparatively modern idea, no older than capitalism, scarcely older than the Industrial Revolution. Now let's think about that for a second. When a privileged class like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett take over, they've got plenty of money, and they reduce the rest of us to serfs. Today we call these employees. They reduce the rest of us to employees working for them. And so in order to aggrandize themselves, they want to abolish labor unions so that they can hold wages and costs down. Under the free enterprise system, which we enjoyed through the Industrial Revolution, we saw labor unions increase, workers' bargaining power increase, workers' wages increase, charitable contributions increased, standard of living increased, and the number of poor decreased, and things were better and better for more and more people. So the question really comes down to, should we have an elite that are 100% totally taken care of, which is a very small minority compared to a great majority of people who are in want and poverty? Or should we raise the level of the standard of living of the masses of people? And if so, how should we do that? Is it good, then, in short, to have masses of people own private property? Well, here in the United States, and generally speaking in the Western world, the answer to that is a resounding yes. And because millions of people own their own homes, those millions of people put in swimming pools.
But when a landlord owns hundreds of houses, he doesn't put any swimming pools into any of those properties. I know, I used to be a landlord. I never put a swimming pool in. But when people own their own homes, they will put roofs on their houses. Landlords delay putting the roof on the house to the last minute. So when one landlord owns 100 houses, he's very stingy. When 100 private owners own 100 houses, they're very liberal, and they're constantly making improvements to their houses. By making these improvements, they employ a lot of people, putting on roofs, building swimming pools. So the bottom line is, when you have thousands and thousands and millions of people who own private property, they spend money more freely than a few people who own those same properties. And the more money that's being spent, then the more money's in circulation, the more money in circulation, the more employment, the more benefits, the more prosperity, then, and it builds upon itself. And then we have more charity, then we have more. Or we can revert back to socialism. Socialism is where we have a few strong hands that own most or all of the property, as opposed to competitive capitalism, where those few strong hands own a share of the property, but most of the property is in the hands of millions and millions of the proletariat. I mean, that's the choice to be made. And our choice now is we want to concentrate this wealth into more and more hands. As in the case of the 2,600 car companies, we have decided in America that instead of having 2,600 car companies, we just want three. We want all of that industrial capacity concentrated in a few strong hands. And at least with 2,600 car companies, you had 2,600 business owners building automobiles. Today, you only have three. Is society better off having 2,600 car companies with 2,600 owners of car companies, or are we better off with three car companies and 2,500 and 97 guys working for those three car companies as employees? I mean, that's a choice that we had to make. We made it. Now you answer the question, do you think that's better? Hey, we're at the halfway point. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use in this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. We need to keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org and georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the free enterprise system. It's commonly called competitive capitalism. That's the term that was coined by Karl Marx. I don't know if it's a better term or as good as. The free enterprise system is predicated upon private property. Private property is guaranteed by the Eighth Commandment. The Eighth Commandment says, thou shalt not steal. So the free enterprise system is part and parcel with the Mosaic Law. It comes from the Mosaic Law, and those that practice the law of God, that is just weights and balances, gold and silver coin, have come out better than those that practice usury, debt, paper money, central banks. In other words, all of those things that we practice under the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto produce poverty. Those things that we produce under the 10 commandments produce abundance and wealth. That's been the history of the program. Now, starting about 1900, we decided that the 10 commandment model wasn't good enough. It didn't produce the utopia that we thought it should. And that's one of the arguments here, that since the free enterprise system has not produced the kind of utopia that we think we ought to have, that what we need is an autocrat sitting in the White House, that we need power concentrated in a few hands to bring about this utopia. Now, this author is pointing out that where we've tried that, for instance, in Iran with the Ayatollah, do they have utopia with their top-down centralized government? Ayn Rand? Just, you know, yes or no. Do you have utopia in places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia? Can you point anywhere in the world to these utopias in these top-down forms of government? I don't know of any. There may be one or two of them out there. I have heard of a couple of little sheikdoms around the world here, like Abu Dhabi and Dubai, and you know, they seem to have quite a bit of prosperity. Mainly it comes from the West buying their oil, and if we weren't buying their oil and produced our own, I'm not so sure that they'd have so much money and largesse to poke around. But then I'm not sure how the poorest of the poor live in those countries either. Now, here in the United States, Robert Kennedy went down to Mississippi back in 1968. He was running for president. He talked to a lady down there, and they made a newsreel out of it, and he said, if we can afford to spend billions of dollars on this war in Vietnam, surely we can do better than this. We can spend more money here. As we pointed out, well, what were you going to do, feed this lady a fish? Now, there's an old adage that says, you know, if you teach a man to fish, he'll be fed for life. If you feed him a fish, he'll be fed for one meal. Government wants to take your money and feed these people, just like the clergy does. They want constantly for you to give them money so that they can keep their soup kitchens open, so they can keep feeding these people, these winos, down on Skid Row. But does that ever solve the wino's problem? Does it ever get him off booze? Does it ever get him back to a productive capacity for himself and for the people around him, or does it just make him more dependent? He's dependent upon booze to start with, and now he's dependent upon the food kitchen to feed him. Does it ever make him independent? Now, the black man in America was more independent in 1900 than he is today. Have we done any great benefits to the black people in America by giving them all this largesse, all of this welfare, food stamps? Now, the choice, you know, has already been made. I'm not here to tell you how to run your business. You've already decided that that's what you want to do. But shouldn't we take a look at it and see, well, what has been the results of it? If you want to just go out and catch fish and bring those fish in and give them away and feed these people, that's fine. I mean, if that's what you want to do, it solves everybody's problem. Gives you something to do, keeps you off the streets and out of the pool halls. And it keeps the people who are dependent upon you dependent upon you. Now, if that's what you want, well, then that's the system you ought to stick with. That's what we've got. Now, if we want to make these people independent, we call it tough love. And I got a son, he came home one day and he said, hey, this is the way things ought to be. And I said, I don't think so. Not here, not in these gates. And he said, you know, you've got this honey-coated trap. Yeah, yeah. I got a honey-coated trap. I got a farm, and I've got all of the goods and services and the things that people want. But in order to benefit from them, you have to follow the law. You got to practice the Ten Commandment model. And he doesn't want to do that. He wants to practice the communist model, but he wants the Ten Commandment results. Now, here's the bottom line to that, children. I don't think you can achieve that. I don't think you can get the Ten Commandment results by practicing the Ten Plank model. That's what we all want. And I don't deny it. But bottom line, I think you're going to be bitterly disappointed, just like my boy. Now, free and responsible. You ever heard of free and responsible? The dawn of conscience, that point in history in which individuals were first argued to be morally free and therefore responsible for their own actions, appeared in Egypt and was borrowed and developed by the Jews. Jesus and his interpreter, St. Paul, in the New Testament, outlined a view which recognized the unique personality of each human being. It is essentially an individualistic view of mankind in which, for the first time, the individual soul is the most important thing about it. Christianity provided an environment in which individuals, to gain salvation, made choices from a position of free will. Not only did the church find that individual souls were worth saving, but Christianity also implanted the concept of the rule of law and contributed importantly to the establishment of the idea of freehold property and the land deed in the Western world. Now, admittedly, these contributions were largely to protect the church and its institutions and property from the power of the state, but over time, this principle of the rule of law and private ownership of property were progressively expanded to the relationships between individuals. The connection between Christian morality and capitalism thus centers essentially around the role and the importance of the individual, according to Paul Johnson. And I just pointed that out, that individuals, a million individual homeowners, will do more for the economy and for themselves in relationship to their own homes than will 1,000 landlords who own 1,000 of those properties. Because when I was a landlord, I spent as little as possible on my property so that I could exact as much profit as possible off of that property. And I think any landlord is going to act in his own personal self-interest. So the free enterprise system is inherently selfish. Absolutely inherently selfish. And that's exactly correct, because human beings are inherently selfish, pure and simple. Human beings are motivated by these five motivators. Now write this down, because it's the first thing we're going to teach in sales school. When a student comes in here, first thing I show him in business school says, look, the most important thing in business is profit. That's the bottom line. Profit, boys and girls, is the only reason for business. Business does not exist for any other purpose. I don't care whether you're Bill Gates with $37 billion or Joe Sixpack, who's working with a lunch bucket. Profit is the only reason that Joe's working. And then profit's the only reason that Bill Gates exists. Now, that being the case, I mean, you can sit here and pontificate until hell freezes over, but you can't change anything. I might listen to preachers and sages and philosophers, you know, pontificate about love and all this crap, but when we get down to the bottom line, here are the five motivators. Write them down. Vanity, number one. That's your number one motivator. And women are especially vain, especially about beauty. Oh, my God. Is my hair fixed just right? You know, do my lips look good? Is my lipstick on straight? Vanity. Second, jealousy. And the third is lust. The fourth is greed. And then the fifth is fear. Governments use fear as their primary tool. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. That's the five motivators of human nature. That's why you buy what you buy. That's why you act the way you act. That's why you do what you do, like it or lump it. There it is. Now, these are five base emotions or reactions in human nature. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. They're not any of them good. And I didn't design it that way. I'm just a reporter. I'm just here to tell you that you're immensely vain, overwhelmingly jealous, filled with lust, totally greedy, and extremely fearful. That's you and me and everybody else. Now, that being the case, then how do we take those five motivators of human nature and channel those so that we can get the most good out of it? Because that's the way people are. I mean, they just like it or lump it. When you're an employer and you're hiring a guy, you're hiring a guy that's vain, jealous, lustful, greedy, and fearful. When you're going to go to work for some guy, your boss is lustful, greedy, fearful, jealous, and vain. That describes Bill Gates and Warren Buffett to a T. Hell, it describes George Gordon and you and me and everybody else to a T, right there. There's human nature, right there in all of its ugly glory. Now, along comes some utopian, you know, like Karl Marx, and says, oh, my God, we've got to change this vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Well, okay, how are you going to do that? Well, what we'll do is we'll take this guy's property, we'll take his house, and we'll make him a part of the proletariat, and we'll remold this man until we change his character. Well, okay, good luck, you know. You've been trying that in China now for the last 50 or 75 years. How many of these Chinese have you straightened out from their vain, jealous, lust, greed, and fear? Well, come on. I'm not going to say, well, Catholicism does it, or Muslimism does it, or Jehovah's Witnesses can do it. You know, you can make your own choices as to what religious ideology or political philosophy you want to subscribe to. But from where I'm sitting here, looking back over history from the Garden of Eden to last night at 5 o'clock, I haven't seen anybody yet that's been able to change vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Not one. Now, you and I can change our own vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, but in order to do that, we have to have a motivation. Why do I want to do that? Well, if there's something for me to gain from it, that's why people put swimming pools in their backyard, because they're going to get to swim in their own private swimming pool, and that appeals to their vanity. When people put swimming pools in their backyard, it's just vanity. When people go out and buy a Porsche automobile, it has nothing to do with transportation. It's just vanity, pure and simple. That's why people buy Corvettes and Rolls Royces. Now, in order to satisfy that vanity, there are people that have to go to work to make those Rolls Royces and put in those swimming pools, and that's where economic prosperity really takes off. Because George Gordon, as a landlord, is never going to put a swimming pool in for my proletariat workers in my apartment house. I mean, hell's going to freeze over before I put a swimming pool in for you people. Why? Well, because I'm greedy. Pure and simple, just plain greedy. I want that money for myself. I'll put a swimming pool in my backyard, but I'll be damned if I'll put a swimming pool in your backyard. But hey, listen, Bob, you would put a swimming pool in your backyard if you could. If you owned that house, you might put a swimming pool in your backyard, just like I might put one in my backyard. But Bob, hell's going to freeze over before you put a swimming pool in my backyard, and you know it as well as I do. So both of us are greedy. Both of us are vain. Both of us are jealous. Both of us are fearful. Come on. Now, how do you and I do business in such a way that because of our own inherent character flaws, we're vain, jealous, lustful, greedy, and fearful? And the best system that we have observed so far in human experience has been this free enterprise system, where you own your own private property and I own my own private property. Let's test it. You and I get shipwrecked on a desert island. Now, I'm an old man, and you're a young man, and you're very limber, and you can climb those coconut trees and banana trees, and you can get coconuts and bananas. I can't climb those trees. I'm too old, too frail. And then if I fell out of that tree, it'd kill me. And if you fell out of that tree, you'd skin your knee. And so I can't have coconuts and bananas. And I look at you, and you're just eating coconuts and bananas just right and left. But because of my skills, I build a boat. And I'm out with my boat catching fish. And because I'm a good swimmer, and because you can't swim, and because I'm a carpenter and you're not, and because I can build a boat and you can't, you don't have any fish to eat. Now, you got lots of bananas and lots of coconuts and no fish. And I've got lots of fish, but I've got no coconuts and no bananas. So one day I come to you and I say, look, when I go out fishing, it's just as easy for me to catch 10 fish as it is one. And when you go up in that coconut tree, it's just as easy for you to pick two coconuts as it is one. So why don't we do this? Well, the next time you go up that coconut tree, throw down two coconuts. And the next time that I go out fishing, I'm going to catch two fish. When I come back to shore, I will trade you one fish for one coconut. And there's the basis of business. We're still just as vain, jealous, lustful, greedy, and fearful as we've always been. But let's just you and me decide, you know, just among ourselves, to better ourselves. And when we get through at the end of the day, we're both going to have fish and coconuts to eat instead of just fish or just coconut. And that's what life is all about. It's improving your standard of living. Now all of a sudden we find that between the two of us, we have a higher standard of living. We've now doubled our productivity between the two of us. And that's all we're talking about with the free enterprise system. Nobody's putting a gun to your head and forcing you to throw down two coconuts or climb the coconut tree or take the risk of falling out of the tree. And nobody's putting a gun to my head and forcing me to go out and catch two fish instead of one and forcing me to risk my life and limb on the high seas. I'm doing it voluntarily because I want a coconut, and you're doing it voluntarily because you want a fish. And that's the essence of the free enterprise system. It's just that simple. No fuss, no muss. Out of turn. I'm going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.